I'm Giuseppe Gagliardi, co-editor-in-chief of Techniques in Coloproctology, from the International Conference of Anal Fistula meeting in Rome. And I'm here sitting with Mr. Phil Tozer from St. Mark's Hospital. Phil, welcome very much to this podcast.
Thanks very much, Giuseppe.
And I heard your talk yesterday, your lecture on the future of the fistula treatment, and there was one thing that struck me is that you were proposing not to even look for the internal opening when you drain an abscess, and even if you do find an internal opening, not to put the seton in. I know most of us would agree not to do a fistulotomy at that point because you're in the middle of inflammation. But I think this is the first time I heard that putting a seton inside would be deleterious. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. It's all based on the immediate fistula treatment literature. You'll know that there have been half a dozen randomized controlled trials looking at patients who have their abscesses drained versus those who have their abscesses drained and then any resulting fistula treated either with fistulotomy if it's low, as you say, or with a seton inserted. And these randomized controlled trials have been reviewed in two systematic reviews, one of them a Cochrane review. And the wisdom from those was that the right thing to do is treat the fistula because recurrence is then reduced and the risks to continence and so on are minimal. In fact, looking at the data, I think, tells us a very different story. Two of those studies only randomized patients who had internal openings. So these are the patients where the advice that you've just been describing would be to place a seton. But in the drainage-only arms of those two studies, only up to about one in three patients returned with a fistula. And that means that all the other patients, the two-thirds or more of patients who wouldn't have returned to see anybody with a fistula will have had one essentially created or at least been made to persist by the placement of the seton. And so those patients, those two-thirds, have been disadvantaged by being exposed to the risks of fistula treatment in the future. And it's those patients that I think we should protect by avoiding treatment of a fistula, even when that's only placing a seton in a primary anorectal abscess. I think it's different in Crohn's disease or with recurrent abscesses where the fistula is essentially established and isn't going away. But first time round, I don't think there's a good reason to intervene.
This is very interesting. And I am going to now ask you about the overall fistula treatment algorithm. And you mentioned that you need to address several factors when you're looking at fistula treatments. You mentioned five of them, and can you tell our listener what these five factors are?
So this is based on some work that we recently published in APT with regards to Crohn's fistulas, but actually I think it applies to the kind of chronic, recurrent, difficult cryptoglandular fistulas too. Why is it that the sphincter-preserving procedures that we perform don't work in all patients, only seem to work part of the time? I think the answer is that the pathophysiology here is multifactorial and that these techniques tend to deal with only one or perhaps two of those factors. So if we think about epithelialization as a cause of fistula persistence, about the primacy and importance of that area around the internal opening and the intersphincteric space, and also about three factors which lead to a very hostile environment in the perineum, which is always acting against us when we're trying to obtain fistula healing. And those are an immunopathology, microbiological abnormality, and also a failure of wound repair. And I think the right way to think about these is a tip of the balance away from wound repair and tissue healing and towards unregulated ongoing inflammatory drive, which will always prevent tissues from healing. So what we must do with our sphincter preserving treatments is to try to combat all of these. Now, if we do a lift procedure, we deal with the disconnection from the tract, we deal with that intersphincteric space really effectively, but we don't do anything about the hostile environment. And perhaps that's why in Crohn's disease it's less efficacious, probably, than we see in cryptoglandular disease. We do try to deal with the epithelialization by scraping the track out, or some people excise the external component, but particularly in the internal opening, we don't necessarily do that effectively. By contrast, something like laser fistula treatment will ablate the inside of the tract, it will destroy any epithelialization, and it may have an impact on immunopathology. I don't think anyone really knows that, but it's possible that it allows that clock to reset in terms of the immunopathology and microbiological factors within the fistula tract. Stem cells or medical treatment of Crohn's disease, you know, they only combat that hostile environment. They don't have any real impact on the other aspects of it. But if we combine stem cells with closure of the internal opening, or we combine medical treatment with closure of the internal opening, or perhaps with another treatment like LIFT, which disconnects the tract from the gut, we're attacking more of these pathophysiological elements. And we will probably find as we go forward and study this in depth that the more aspects of the pathophysiology that we are dealing with and ameliorating, the more effective our treatments will be.
Thank you very much for summarizing it for us. And I now want to go through the many different, especially the newer treatments that we have been discussing at this meeting, and see what is your opinion, if you're using them at St. Mark's, or what do you think is their role. And let's start with fistula plugs. So we discussed there are some biologic plugs and some new synthetic plugs that act like a biologic plug, such as the Gore fistula plug, and even newer one. Do you use plugs in your at St. Mark's? Do you use plugs in your experience? What is their indication? Which type you're using?
The answer is that we pretty much don't. Certainly, traditionally, St. Mark's has tried the plug and felt that it really wasn't very effective at all. My predecessor, Robin Phillips, was known to say to Kirk and to people who advocate for the plug, bring me a patient, show me one patient in whom the plug has genuinely healed their fistula. In truth, I think there probably is some value in the plug, but it's not something that we have great experience with. Carolyn Vasey at St. Mark's did a little bit of work with one of the newer plugs, but we really haven't adopted it. If we were going to, then we would be interested only in straight transsphincteric tracts, and we would only use it in the absence of Crohn's disease.
How about To stay in this area of foreign bodies, how about injection of fibrin glue or injection of permacol paste?
I think fibrin glue has fallen pretty much completely out of favour. The permacol paste alone also really hasn't demonstrated particular benefit, and we haven't taken it on. But again, as part of a combined treatment, as an adjunct, as a carrier perhaps for stem cells, for drugs, for other biologically active materials, as part of a multifactorial treatment, there might potentially be a place for it in the future, but we don't use it other than that at all.
So no plug, no fibrin, and no paste injection at St. Mark's for now. And do you do LIFT procedures?
Yeah, we do, and we like the LIFT procedure. We have, up till this point, used it mostly in non-Crohn's fistulas, but we're starting to use it in Crohn's disease more now. It's a nice technique. It requires some surgical skill and finding the insphincteric space, particularly in the scarred insphincteric space, can be quite challenging. I think it's really important to choose the right patients. I would never do it on somebody with intersphincteric complexity, so horseshoeing or additional tracts in the insphincteric space, or if it spends much time travelling through the insphincteric space between the two sphincters. nor would I do it in a fistula that was too high. It can be very difficult to make your way up the sphincteric space to get to the tract. And also it worries me that the top of the tract and the rectum, when you have a very high transphincteric fistula, can be very closely approximated, and the risk of injury to the rectum then appears. And I also don't like it if the internal opening is very deep and wide. And sometimes, you know, all of the surgeons will recognize the situation where the internal opening seems massive, and in fact what you've got is a deep pit running into the sphincteric space all the way to the external sphincter. And I think in that situation, I think it's very difficult to perform the procedure, and I think there's a great risk of running into the fistula tract, which really in that situation means running into the anal canal. And I think that's another indication, a contraindication for its use. But those aside, a nice tract with a good passage across the sphincteric space, which is easily accessible, I think it's a lovely operation to do.
I remember when I was at St. Mark's, and Robin Phillips was the youngest attending, now he just retired. He was performing a lot of fistulotomy or fistulectomies and sphincter repair. And we heard this option here, especially the Germans and Carlo Ratto, they always perform a sphincter repair together with a fistulotomy or fistulectomy. Can you comment on this?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. He, towards the end of his career, he had completely stopped doing that. He didn't see any great benefit. I think if a fistula is low enough, that whether your sphincter repair works or not doesn't really matter, then there's no point in doing it. And much of the literature regarding sphincter repair reports a significant risk of difficulty controlling wind and maybe a little bit of minor soiling, which is exactly what we would expect with layopen of most anal fistulas. The very highest fistulas that one can't lay open without a greater, without a risk of a greater degree of continence impairment, are much more difficult, because if you undertake your layopen and then your sphincter repair fails, well then the patient is in a very difficult situation. The sphincter repairs will inevitably fail in some patients, and I think the literature has been relatively poor at teasing out which patients have genuinely benefited from the sphincter repair and which haven't, and also which patients have been disadvantaged by a failed sphincter repair and which haven't. And I think that's our great fear. But the counter argument is the question about the contour of the anus. And I think that there is some value in that. So if you can recreate the contour of the anus more effectively, that probably does have a beneficial effect in terms of defecation and continence. I don't think it's well quantified, but I think there is probably something in that, and I'm looking forward to future publications which discuss it.
So you do a fistulotomy and a marsupialization?
Yes, and the marsupialization certainly makes me feel better. I'm not sure if it has much of an impact on the patient. There's some evidence about wound healing and bleeding and pain being reduced. Wound healing being advantaged, of course, the other two being reduced. And certainly we do it. Mostly, though, we do it as a part of wound shaping. And I think if you create a large layopen, you want that area to be able to drain effectively out of the anus. And so you need to create a furrow, which will be made easier with marsupialization. But you also sometimes need to do a salmon back cut or similar to open up that area at the outer end, the lateral end of your furrow, to allow it to drain well.
Let's move on to fancier options. And I've heard with interest that you acquired at St. Mark's a fistuloscope. So for the VAFT, it's, which stands for video-assisted anal fistula treatment. This has not been FDA approved in the United States. And you're having some interesting experience with the VAFT. You're not only using it for the traditional fistuloscopy and to assist the fistula closure and the cauterization of the tract, but you also were discussing earlier on some other indications.
Yeah, I think the VAFT scope is a very interesting and useful piece of equipment. I'm not convinced that I will be able to heal lots of fistulas by using it in the curative fashion that Professor Meniero advocates so brilliantly, but I think it has enormous utility. The first and most difficult to define is that I think it adds a greater degree of understanding of fistulas in general and of the fistula in front of you when you're able to put the scope into it. You can feel where the scope is, you can tell exactly which cavities and which aspects of which tracts you've got into. And I think it's a really nice way to improve your understanding of the anal fistula in general and the one that you're treating. In addition to using it curatively, though, we also think there are other techniques, as you said. Now, the first that we've worked on for the last several months, and that's been written up by one of our research fellows, Sam Adegbola, and has been led by Janindra Warasavatani, another one of the consultants, is the palliative VAFT, and that's using the VAFT scope within the Crohn's setting to reduce symptoms. We allowed patients to choose which symptoms were most important to them, and they ubiquitously chose discharge and pain. And then most of them demonstrated that their pain and discharge had improved following their treatment and felt very pleased with the treatment having been performed. I should say that this wasn't blinded works. There's obviously a considerable placebo effect associated with surgery, but it was a first indication that the palliative use of this, and let's face it, most of these Crohn's patients with fistulas are going to have ongoing fistulas with ongoing symptoms perpetually, so managing those with drugs and setons and perhaps also by using the palliative VAFT might be a way in which we can improve their symptoms. There's also the Delta VAFT, and this is something that we're looking at. I'm not sure which way it's going to turn out yet. And that is the idea that we can take a tract which at the moment is not suitable for one of the sphincter-preserving procedures. Perhaps there's an extension or a cavity that prevents us doing laser fistula treatment or lift or whatever. And treating that cavity, that extension, that additional tract, so that the morphology of the fistula changes, the cavity shrinks away and disappears, and we're left only with that primary transphincteric tract, which we can then treat with one of our other techniques. Now, in addition to those three, curative, palliative, and Delta VAFT, we've also used it to inspect cavities and take biopsies, and also in the case of trying to pass a very difficult seton. Many of the surgeons listening will know that some tracts, let's say a transphincteric tract, which enters the intersphincteric space and then horseshoes round posteriorly before turning through a second right angle to enter the anal canal at 6 o'clock, is incredibly difficult sometimes to put a seton into. Now, we can make a large incision in the ischioanal fossa to straighten out the first right angle and make it easier. Or we can use the VAFT, and we've now done this a few times, placing the VAFT, placing a seton through the internal opening, using a fistula probe, and then using the VAFT to reach that point, grasp the seton, and pull it through the rest of the tract, and in that way place the seton in these very difficult tracts without having to make a cut on the patient, which I think is enormously valuable.
Let's briefly talk about some new kids on the block, the laser fistula treatment and the over-the-scope clip, speaking about, which looks like a stapler gun and delivers this nitinol clip to the internal opening to close it. Do you have experience with any of the two?
So we don't use the over-the-scope clip. I'm certainly interested in alternative ways to close the internal opening. I think it needs to demonstrate a benefit over simple suture closure, but it's certainly interesting. My concern about it is the number of patients within any of the studies in whom the clip migrates or has to be taken out because of pain. I appreciate that Prost denudes the mucosa for a 2 centimeter diameter around the internal opening, but nevertheless, that side of things concerns me. But it's an interesting idea, and certainly closing off the internal opening robustly is of value in fistula treatment. We do have experience with the laser. We're using it in a number of different situations, but broadly speaking, straight transphincteric tracts without any branches or cavities tend to be the most appropriate. We haven't done enough to publish a robust success rate, But as with all of the sphincter-preserving procedures that I've described, when I consent a patient, I talk about, first of all, what the published success rate is, and then I temper that, explaining that I expect it's likely to sit around 50% by the time a few more publications and a few more years have passed. And that's what I expect patients to be able to look forward to.
The areas that we discuss about the laser are closure versus non-closure of the internal opening and high energy versus low energy. Which way do you go?
So I think we should close the internal opening. We didn't do that with all of our cases initially because when the tracts are very narrow, the laser probably does the job for you. But I think robust closure is the right thing to do, and Arnie Wilhelm has been very clear about that. In terms of energy, it sounds trite to say that one must use the right amount, but I think that's the answer. We are relatively low energy users, and we certainly don't want to see the white smoke appearing. If you're standing in this neck of the woods when the new Pope is being elected, then seeing white smoke is a good thing. But when you're doing phylac, it is a bad thing, and it means that the liquid has all vanished and the tissues are being destroyed. So I would advocate, as Arnie does within his papers, slow passage with energy delivery. We probably spend about a second every 1 or 2 centimetres, maybe a little bit more than that. And over a 3 or 4 centimetre tract, I might expect to use 150 or 200 joules, but probably not more than that.
I'm bombarding you with questions, and this is, I promise, is going to be the last one. We heard so many different aspects of treatment of fistula and Crohn's disease, but one that is the most innovative is definitely the injection of stem cell, which is recently published in a randomized trial on The Lancet. And those are commercially available, and are you using injection of adipose-derived stem cell at Marks for Crohn's fistulas?
So that's a good question. So a couple of points first. I've done a bit of work speaking on behalf of Takeda and taken part in 1 or 2 advisory boards to try to help them to bring this product to market in the UK, because we're very keen to get our hands on it. Having said which, I've no financial or other interest in the company going forwards, nor in whether or not stem cells genuinely work, except of course my interest in them helping our patients. We don't have access to them yet. They will hit the UK in about September. Two units, we and Sheffield, have been identified as places with sufficient volume and experience and rigorous technique to put stem cells through their paces. In particular, it's important because the logistics of stem cells, their delivery from the lab in Spain into the patient, all has to take place within a 48-hour period, and that can be very challenging. So Takeda are, I think, wisely starting off with only a small number of centres, which will expand. I'm very excited about using it because I want to see if it works. The ADMIRE-CD trial was a great study. You know, there are 1 or 2 things that we all talk about, but using the combined clinical radiological endpoint was a really powerful step forwards. The delta was only 15%. They had a good, strong treatment in the comparator arm, but nevertheless, we're only seeing a small uplift with the stem cells. But if there is a genuine uplift there, if we can genuinely augment other techniques by ameliorating the hostile environment with the stem cells, then I think we'll have opened the door to a really important part of the multifactorial treatment of this multifactorial problem. The first step is getting it into our hospitals, using it in our patients, seeing if it does demonstrate the benefit that we have been shown in ADMIRE-CD, and then starting to think about how we can use it in other and more creative ways.
This concludes my interview, and thank you very much, Phil, for sharing your great knowledge on fistula with our listeners.
Thanks, Giuseppe. It's my pleasure.